After his Angelus, Pope Benedict called on young migrants to dedicate themselves to building a more just and fraternal society. He asked them to fulfil their duties, respect laws, and to not be carried away by violence. The Pope was marking the World Day of Refugees, which this year is dedicated to young migrants. He mentioned that amongst younger migrants, young women and minors are particularly at risk, and he pointed out that some children and adolescents are born and raised in refugee camps and that they have a right to a future. The Pope's words sounded so just and also somewhat familiar. Just a while back, I clearly remember reading a press release urging new policies foreseeing alternatives to the immigration detention of children. Children and Families, the paper issued by a coalition of organisations called the IDC, said, should not be held in immigration detention. There are other ways. I immediately called up Jesuit Refugee Services, a member of the IDC's steering committee, in search of someone who could tell me more. I spoke to James Stapleton, communications coordinator with JRS in Rome, who invited me to come round for a chat. But before going into the issue of immigration detention of children, I did ask him to explain exactly what the IDC is.
The IDC is the International Coalition on the Detention of Asylum Seekers, Refugees and Migrants. It was set up 2 years ago by 100 organisations and individuals around the world who felt that we needed to concentrate advocacy work on the detention of these particularly vulnerable groups. They came together and there was a launch. There were simultaneous launches all around the world. And when we talk about vulnerable groups, I suppose children are one of the most, if not the most vulnerable group, and we felt we needed to concentrate very quickly on what the situation was for children being held in detention around the world. And it was felt that we needed to look at what was the existing research, what were our members telling us, and to come up with a position paper to see if any circumstances could the detention of children be justified.
It's actually quite shocking to read this because there is talk about the predicament of asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants, and very little thought is generally given to the children. Well, are they children who come with their families? Who are these children? And do you have a vague idea of how many or what percentage of these people are children?
Unfortunately, global statistics are impossible to be able to get. There are very few countries who, if they collect statistics, make those statistics available. The UK is one of the countries that generally makes its statistics available, but around the world, the numbers, we just don't really know. What we do know, from the samples we've been able to look at, about half of the children who are detained are unaccompanied children. They're actually coming without their families. And this is extremely worrying, no, because they're separated from their families, they're fleeing all forms of persecution and human rights abuses and trauma. And then what we feel is happening is they're being re-traumatized because states feel they need to control their borders. And this is the primary focus. And the primary focus doesn't seem to be on the welfare of children. And so that's exactly why we started to look at this. We started to say, okay, states do have a right to control their borders, but those rights are not absolute. And what we're calling on states to do is to look at every situation in which they detain, particularly children, and make a judgment on the basis of the evidence, the needs of the children and the needs of the states. And we feel that in many cases, states are using a sledgehammer to crack a nut and they're detaining children, if you like, to send out a message to other groups of people, please don't come here because here is going to be hard.
More or less, what age range are the children?
I think that we can broadly say that the children with families can be any age. We really do find
even toddlers,
even find children born in detention centres, women who are arriving in pregnant, and sometimes those pregnancies are actually as a result of violence experienced in their countries of origin. When we talk about unaccompanied minors, I think we're generally talking about a group between 16 to 18. We're talking about young kids, many of them who have been involved in conflicts, or conflicts have affected their lives very, very closely, and they have fled, sometimes because they don't want to be involved in the conflict, or sometimes because they need to get away from the conflict. And these are a particularly difficult group because what's happening is states are saying, We don't believe you're 16. We don't believe you're 17. Even the states, if you like, with the best practices who don't detain children are carrying out these x-rays on teeth and using other methods to calculate age, which are highly inaccurate.
Of course, they come without documents, right?
Yeah. And in many cases, they're told to destroy their documents by the people who help them to get in, the smugglers who are providing them with the fake documents to get in, because there's virtually no state in the world, if you apply for a visa saying your reasons for applying for a visa is because you're fleeing persecution, there's virtually no state in the world that will actually grant you access into their country.
In fact, James says, most states actually take active steps to prevent the arrival of people fleeing persecution when conflict is ongoing. And this, he points out, hurts the weakest, and the weakest, in many cases, are the children.
And I don't think the organisations who make up the IDC are asking for anything which is unusual. What they're saying to states is, look, there are other ways to do this. What about open centres? What about sign-on practices? Particularly when you look at children with families. I mean, in Sweden, what's happened is family units are not detained unless there is an absolute necessity to do so, I mean, a threat to the national security. And even in those circumstances, what you're seeing is you have a family group that comes in, children, mother, father, and the father may be detained. And the children and the family have access to their father. And it's very clear that in many cases, the family, I think in the United States, there was a study done, and they said that 93% of the people that were given some form of bail showed up for their hearing. So you're talking about detaining 100 people for the possibility that 7 will abscond. And again, a sledgehammer to crack a nut.
Which countries are the worst offenders?
It's really difficult to say one country is worse than another, because in many cases you have one country with a good practice in one area and then other pretty appalling practices. I think we can look at Malaysia, cases of violence against children in detention centres. I think we can talk about Thailand, where there is indefinite detention of children, where there, unless another state is prepared to take these children when they're recognised as refugees, then they can remain in detention indefinitely. I think those are particularly appalling cases. I think in the United States, whilst the United States no longer detains unaccompanied children, they detain families. You can look at cases of good practices in certain areas. When we look at one of the best practices, we would like to highlight Hungary, which doesn't detain any children. But again, they are deeming individuals that we feel may well be children as adults, because they're not giving the benefit of the doubt. The scientific evidence is saying this child is between 16 and 19. And they're saying, well, okay, you're 19 and now you're being detained. And what we're saying to states again is, please use proportionality. What is going to happen if you detain? What is going to happen if you don't detain? Please, in this particular circumstances, give the benefit of the doubt, if there is some doubt. Look at the maturity of the child. Because in many cases as well, you have children, they flee at 17 years of age, they arrive to their country, 17 and a half, they turn 18 and then they're detained. And we're saying, this particular person has experienced a lot of serious trauma at a very young age. Please look at this, the maturity, the trauma that they've experienced in the past before you make the decision to detain, and for that decision not to be arbitrary and automatic.
What are the long-term effects on children who are detained?
The research we have on this area is rather worrying. We've got quite a lot of research that came from Australia, which talked about re-traumatisation, which talked about mental health difficulties, schizophrenia, increased risk of suicide. And if you like, in the better cases, developmental problems in relation to education, that children really had problems studying because of what they had experienced. In a lot of cases, children are being detained with adults who are maybe violent, or with prison populations who are maybe violent, who have experienced a lot of trauma. They're with their families in some cases, and they see their families increasingly becoming more depressed as they're unable to carry out the role of a parent, which is the final arbiter for a child. And those effects we're beginning to see. We have cases, some very extreme cases in Australia, where children have sewn up their lips and refused to speak.
But James says we will still have to wait a lot longer before we really get a grasp on the extent of the psychological damage being done to children in detention today.
It's very dramatic. I mean, these children are fleeing for hopefully a better future, and putting them in a detention centre, you're really taking that future away, because you're you're damaging them so profoundly. What do you hope in the near future can happen?
I think what we hope is that states start to take a more pragmatic approach, that they start to look at their obligations as well as what they want to achieve. We understand that states want to minimize the arrival of irregular migrants, but what we want them to do is when they make decisions, like decisions to detain, that they do it looking at all of the facts, that the costs to the child, the benefits to the state, and they're not just making those decisions automatically to send out a message to future arrivals, because apart from anything else, it just isn't working. You know, you're not going to deter someone fleeing persecution or even extreme poverty in their country of origin by locking them up, because unless your objective is to make the host country conditions worse than the conditions in the country of origin, which really will have profound effects, not only for those children, but also for us, if you like, as a civilization and how we view human beings. I think we really have to look at that. What we're hoping is states to sit down and to start to look at these children, their vulnerability, and to look at their options. I mean, there have been some studies done and some estimates made by various NGOs who talk about the cost of implementing open centres for children is up to one third the cost of detaining, with no significant loss to the state. We're not saying never detain. We're not saying you haven't got the right to what we're saying, but let's do it under the proper circumstances. Detaining someone upon arrival when you absolutely know nothing about what's going to happen to them through the whole asylum period seems to be unjust. What we're saying, if you're talking about a very small period of detention for identification needs, states need to know who are coming into their country. For health checks, states need to make sure that people are coming in, don't have diseases which could be spread. Or you're talking about a very small period of detention when they know that the children can, and the families in the asylum seekers can be sent back to their countries of origin safely, then okay. I think most actors in the NGO area working with asylum seekers, refugees, I think this is acceptable. We're not foolish. We don't believe that states have no interest whatsoever. But what we're saying is please look at the costs to yourself and the cost to the asylum seekers and make those decisions on an individual case and allow those decisions to be reviewed by courts. If you are happy that the decisions that you've made will stand up legally, morally, then allow them to be scrutinised by your legal systems.
It also it seems to make no sense. I mean, if we've got young people coming into the country and who may be staying in our country because most Western countries need new people because of the demographic crises, you'd think that one would want to nurture and help them grow into positive and productive people rather than damaged beings.
I mean, I think that's a real issue for states, not just in relation to the detention issue, but it's in relation to the whole migration and refugee issue. Integration, and that's what we're talking about, is very much a two-way process. It's about the host society and host society's willingness to accept this new community and the migrant or refugee community's willingness to integrate. And I think we see that this relationship is very much characterized by the early stages. When the experiences are very, very bad or quite traumatic at the start, the capacity and the willingness of refugees and migrants to be able to integrate into the future is circumvented. And we think that states really, in their own interest, need to take this into account, because what we don't want is a disenfranchised, traumatized community which is reluctant to integrate in the future, because we've seen some of the situations that are now occurring in various parts of Europe. And I think we have the time to learn, you know, not to make the same mistakes that we've made in the past.